my name is Teresa Nunez, and we have number 7, which is constructing racism. And as you all know, race is a really touchy situation. It's an issue that has affected all of us in some way or another. Throughout history, through institutional policies, and everything, everybody's been affected. So what we did is that we were researching, and we wanted to bring something new to the, to do something different. So we found this thing on white privilege that I've never even heard of, and I was like really, you know, drawn to it. And I was thinking, oh my God, what is this? You know, it sounds like, you know, good information, but you know, what's the structure? Who's behind it? And we wanted to get some more information. Well, we didn't think we're going to find a lot of information. But the more we looked, it was all over the place. And then all of a sudden, we started seeing it everywhere we looked. And so then we kind of like started to experience it more and more, because a lot of times, you know, when we experience white privilege, we don't even know what's happening. And we are, or we don't know that it's happening to us, or that there's some sort of form of racism being done to a non-white person. And when I say non-whites, I'm talking about everybody other than white. And so what we did was we said, okay, so what is it? And so it's the unspoken privilege of a white person who has benefited from some form of unearned advantage taken from a non-white and putting that non-white at a disadvantage. Okay? We were fortunate enough to find this book named The Heart of Whiteness. And I put up some pamphlets up there. And it has a little face. And that's the book cover. Okay? And The Heart of Whiteness is about confronting race, racism, and white privilege. And this is written by Robert Jensen, who is white. Okay? He's a professor in journalism from the University of Texas. Okay. He claims that all Americans with European backgrounds have some certain expectations of high moral standing and have considered themselves the white race, which just means that they're not people of color. Okay. And whiteness also represents normalness. Okay. This idea of whiteness has strong connection to domination and or referred to as white supremacy, which is a really touchy word, which is really horrible. Because when I think of white supremacy, I think of Nazis, I think of KKK, I think of skinheads, I think of running away, hiding. And they don't care if, you know, they don't care what color you are. If you're not white, you're in trouble. Okay. So this is what that's the whole reference of the white supremacy thing. And that connects to forms of racism. Okay. Without even reading the next line, you already knew that just by the examples and the groups that word represents. Some whites would like to think that we have reached the end of racism. You know, I was hoping that we did. I kind of thought we did, you know, reading the history books of the 60s and the civil rights movement. And we said, yeah, you know what? People should not be treated like this. You know, and we thought, hey, you know what? We're really coming into a new light, new century. People are gonna have equal rights. And you know, it was really hopeful, but it was just a thought. Okay. In the United States and others, that would celebrate the diversity, but remain oblivious to like the economic, social, and political effects of a nation founded on the system of white supremacy. I'm talking about, does anybody know what I'm talking about? United States government. The reality of race, racism, and white privilege demonstrates power in the system, and that denies non-white people from full humanity. Humanity is just a person of, you know, mankind. It just, civilization. It just means you and me. Also keeps white people from fully accessing their humanity, okay? By the whites basically oppressing all the non-whites and pressing their dominance on us and their rules and regulations, they're taking a little bit of us away from them, because we're the same. We're just different colors. History. Let's explore the history of the white race behavior. The European whites, called Euro-whites, considered themselves of high intelligence and the explorers of their time. When they were considered, when they considered traveling west, they knew that they were going to confront dark, savage, foul, unstable people who lived in huts or teepees. These people from the west were considered savages of low intelligence and could not compete with the Euro-whites, now referred to as Americans. The idea of the whiteness justified the movement of colonizing savages and the Americans, would claim that they were missionaries assisting and teaching the savages, and ultimately civilizing, which means taming, okay, a primitive culture. So they thought that everybody west had a primitive culture because they were more intelligent. Okay, but that was their opinion. The United States supported the whites, the Americans, called the Bear Flaggers, to confiscate the land of the non-whites. The Bear Flaggers were under the command of a U.S. Army officer named John C. Fremont, who rallied behind the mission to extend further west to the Pacific coast. The American whites' sense of national and racial affiliation proved a powerful force. They were really powerful. They were coming together, and they were just going to take it all. The non-white residents could only imagine that their futures under the U.S. rule would be like. The Americans promised the non-whites would be equal to them in social status, being considered a white themselves. This meant the same opportunities and the same privileges. Okay. The non-white Americans quickly found that the American white settlers would develop new patterns of residency that would exclude the non-whites from the process making and making it difficult for them to learn the new laws without an explanation of the structure. The non-whites were lost, and their social decline of status quickly became the focus on the non-whites as unequal and unworthy. The American whites degraded the non-whites through slander and name-calling, attacking their intelligent race, their intelligence. This race became the issue and ultimately creating a violent society. So they were like basically promoting racism. In order for the Americans to maintain their power, they would need to create levels of social status, okay? And we learned that earlier, you know, when we were doing the whole, you know, upper class and lower class thing. So they were developing this, the levels of social status for the Americans at the top. With this idea of superior status, all non-whites would be left to build their own identities and own order behind the American. So as long as the Americans were on top, everybody could fall into place, whoever it is, catch me if I can, if you can, if you can't, you know, we're still gonna be on top. In terms of stereotypes, the Americans believed that whiteness was a prime example of goodness, okay? And the non-whites were not good. Nor were they intelligent. This idea justified the stereotype idea of non-whites being considered a low class and were not of good people. With the idea in place also assisted to maintain the idea of racism. So it kept them down because they thought, well, the non-whites are dumb, they're lower class, they're savages. We need to tame them. We need to teach them the better life. So you know what? They're not worthy. They're not worthy. They're not even good. Okay? And that was the whole thought process. The Americans wanted the non-whites to reject their cultures, which is also another thing. Whites wanted us to assimilate into their culture, teaching us their beliefs. And they wanted us to just free ourselves from everything we've learned from generation to generation and forego what we believe is our culture and, you know, embrace theirs. And that was really, really difficult. And a lot of people said, you know what, I don't want to do that. You know, I don't want to give up my identity because this has something to do about you, who you are. Not who you want to be, like the iPhone thing, right? The Americans wanted the non-whites to reject their cultures and conform to the norm, and they called it norm. Whiteness is norm, the norm of whiteness. This would mean that the non-whites would have to assimilate into the white community, which was a negative feeling from the beginning. Nearly a century ago, the color line between whites and non-whites remained a force to be dealt with in our society. Where does the concept and practice of whiteness fit into our social process? Okay, it says Americans are the dominant race, okay, period. They make up the rules and change them for personal gain. The bad treatment of non-whites was not something new. It was part of our history, okay? And when I say that, I say our history, everybody knows the history. Thomas Jefferson, you know, had slaves, he enslaved non-whites to pick his cotton and to increase his wealth and to, you know, belittle them and beat them bare minimum, and they were in shacks in the back of his home, but he treated them that way, and that's what this means. They made up the rules that came and changed personal gain. They have that treatment of pain, for example, the slave trade, and taking land by they were taking land and taking it from the owners, and they to form some sort of ethnic cleansing. What they were doing is when they were taking the land, a lot of times they had to dispose of the owner. So a lot of times these people were killed. And they were calling it like ethnic cleansing, like getting rid of the bad race. This view of whiteness is both material and rooted and institutionalized in our government. The American system has been stewing in this myth of democratic society, but in its reality, it's capitalist society provided by all the non-whites in this country who are doing all the work. These non-whites are predominantly poor, undereducated, and puts them in a position of a laborer. Okay. While the power of the position belonging to the boss, the whites, who collect all the benefits. Okay, and these are like examples of white privilege. People walking down the street, opposite direction of each other. Whites coming, non-whites coming. The whites will not move out of the way, almost forcing the non-white to move. But this action of superiority displays actions of ownership and belonging. And the second example, non-whites at restaurants or cafes would get poor service, you know, from the establishment, while the whites would be seated first and or in a better location. Okay, so they won't have the table near the bathroom. So every time the bathroom opens, the door's hitting, you know, somebody in my party's door, or you know, we're seated in the back so that when people come into the establishment and take a little scope, what kind of establishment is it? You know, who's being served here? Oh, okay, all the non-whites are in the back. It looks like a good place to eat because all the whites are in the front. So that's how some people do it. It's embarrassing, it's horrible, but it's true. The unspoken idea of discrimination in stores. Oh my God, discrimination in stores. This, I totally kind of like related to, I couldn't believe it. With non-whites entering the store and being followed or monitored by video or like security guards kind of like behind them or kind of like looking over your shoulder, it's really uncomfortable. While the white customer can freely and comfortably be able to shop without feeling they were being watched or followed. This is a form of harassment, stalking, and racism. Okay, white students know, okay, this is this guy, his name was Powell. In 1997, he was writing an article saying, hey, it's okay that the whites have a structure, at least they have a structure. And this is what he wrote. He said, white students know the rules of the game. He must be a football fan. And are better achievers, okay? Just as members of the white society, they know the rules. They're brought up with them. So he's implying that they're taught this, which is also alarming. This is an advantage of being white. They learn the rules as they grow up, and they succeed in life. Well, yeah, well, you know, you're the boss, you're making the rules. everybody under you or your family that didn't make it. Those who are not white never get a chance to learn the rules, and they are generally not successful. That's what Sky Powell wrote. Okay, economic. Whiteness offers preference of hiring over non-white groups. And there's also like a prejudice or, I would say prejudice, for admission to public events and schools of equal privilege with a classification that whites are the superior race. With this idea of white privilege, the white voting power has advanced whites to official government positions and businesses, securing their superiority, which is the effect of an unbalanced economic structure, and the power putting the non-whites again at the disadvantage. Again. This idea of superiority in the white society is used to place the whites in power of the decision-making for, guess who? All the non-whites, everybody else. The whites are now legally empowered to take from the non-whites whatever they want. This is a form of white supremacy, another form of racism. I can't even say that enough, but I guess I don't have to say it anymore. Forget it. Racism has been institutionalized in our government by placing white presidents. Oh, and I brought this from home. It's my daughter's. And it's a book of all the presidents in the United States. Can anybody tell me what color is our president? Bush, like, and I was reviewing this the other day, and I was like looking at it, my daughter pointed it out to me. Every single president of the United States has been what?
White.
And male.
Yeah, that's another dominance, but we are not going to get into that. So, okay, male dominance. You guys know who you are. Okay, and that was a loophole army, because that's what makes it. This man is like the most powerful man in our country, I mean the nation, and he's making all the decisions for us, which are kind of like bad because, you know, Bush is not doing very well, but it puts him in power and he's representing us, and this is really okay. So, so president's most powerful office in the nation. This form of racism also promotes policies that have slavery and confiscation of land from non-whites, demonstrating the white privilege idea as unearned advantage. The non-white groups struggle, trying to compete and assimilate into society of whiteness. You know, a lot of us try to assimilate, okay, into the American dream and stuff, because we want it too, we want some of that. You know, I should be speaking Spanish. I speak English, that's my first language. Okay, so in some way or another, to get an education, to be successful, we have basically semi-assimilated because I refuse to give up my traditions and my tamales at Christmas. You're not taking them away from me. And I refuse to like have a cross in every room. That is for my grandmother. She made me do that. You know, I don't want to totally assimilate, but I have to if I want to be successful. Okay? Or semi. Okay. But this is similar into society of whiteness, but will fail only because they are not white. Even though I'm assimilating halfway, and even if I try to assimilate all the way, because a lot of my girlfriends call me Oreo, you know, I don't get it, but still. it doesn't bother me because I've been called worse. we fail. We automatically fail. And do you know why we automatically fail? We're disqualified because we're not white. So it's aimed for certain members, and it's not us. There's also examples of fears, okay? And with this, I'd like to turn it over to Alex. And we're going to do like a question and answer period afterward, okay? And so I might be back up. So I'm going to hand it over to Alex.
Okay. I'm going to be talking about the fears that occur to white people. And I'm going to concentrate on the book that Teresa mentioned, is the one of Robert Jensen, The Hidden Racism in the Heart of Whiteness. Basically, in this book, he pinpoints some fears that may occur to this white supremacist society. He mentions that these fears are the reason why many white people are afraid to confront themselves and the system, which basically, you know, is the structure of white privilege. The first and the most crucial fear he explains is the fear of facing the fact that some of what we white people have is unearned. I say we because he, as like Teresa mentioned, he is an author who is white and he wrote this book, so that's why he includes himself in the fears that he fears as well. He explained how it is ordinary that they do not really make it on their own. They always have an advantage of what they achieve. He states, no matter how hard we work or how smart we are, we all know when we are honest with ourselves that we did not get where we are by advantage alone. And many white people are afraid of that fact. A second fear of losing what they have. Literally, the fear of losing things we own if at some point the economic, political, and social system in which we live become more just and equitable. The fear is not completely irrational. If white privilege, along with the other kinds of privilege many of us have, living in the middle class and above, in an imperialist country that dominates much of the rest of the world, were to evaporate, the distribution of resources in the United States and in the world would change, and that would be a good thing. We would have less. That redistribution of wealth would be fairer and more just. But in a world in which people have become used to affluence and material comfort, that possibility can be scary. A third fear he points out is the fear of one day non-white people turning the cards and gaining the power that whites have dominated. He explains this in terms of the constant non-white immigrants. He explains this in the term of non-white immigrants that keep moving to this country and that somehow may one day become the majority demographically. The main reason they fear of this is because they feel that it would become a system in which white people become the minority and could be treated as whites have long treated non-whites. And a final fear that Robert Jensen implies, which has probably always haunted white people, but has become more powerful since the society has formally rejected over racism. The fear of being seen and seen through by non-white people. Virtually every white person I know, including white people fighting for racial justice, and including myself, which is Robert Jensen himself, carry some level of racism in our minds and hearts and our bodies. In our heads, we can pretend to eliminate it, but most of us know it is there. And because we are all supposed to be appropriately anti-racist, we carry that lingering racism with a new kind of fear. What if non-white people look at us and see it? What if they can see it through us? What if they can look past our anti-racist vocabulary and sense that we still don't really know how to treat them as equals? What if they know about us what we don't dare know about ourselves? What if they can see what we can't even voice? So basically, reading this section of his article, it just basically, Robert Jensen himself is a white person, and he basically just explained the fears that what would happen if basically we would just become non-racist, you know, and just live in an equal environment. So he himself, being of this society, explains the fears that he himself fears as well. And as well, doing some research, I found this. Her name is Peggy McIntosh, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, and she basically is also a white person, and as well as Robert Jensen wrote a book about it as well. And let me just read really quick about her. Peggy McIntosh is an associate director of the Wellesley College Center for Research on Women. This essay is excerpted from Working Paper 189, White Privilege and Male Privilege, a personal account of coming to see correspondence through work in the women's studies. by Peggy McIntosh. So basically, she also put daily effects of white privilege. This is her speaking. I decided to try to work on myself, at least by identifying some of the daily effects of white privilege in my life. I have chosen those conditions that I think, in my case, attach somewhat more to skin color privilege than to class, religion, ethnic status, or geographic location. Though, of course, all these other factors are intertwined. As far as I can tell, my African-American co-workers, friends, and acquaintances with whom I come into daily or frequent contact in this particular time, place, and time of work cannot count on most of these conditions. So I'm going to pass out really quick. It's just basically she lives some stuff that she comes into contact as well because of her, of course, you know, being white. And then other than that, I'm going to pass this out and then I'm going to turn it over to Tiffany.
Good evening, Professor Ruben and fellow students. My name is Tiffany. I'm currently working for a civil education firm in Pasadena. Having grown up in the People's Republic of China, I left my home country, came to the United States for the purpose of seeking a better life and pursuing a further education. Since I came to this country, I have been observing, working, studying, and becoming a part of American cultural scene. This has been taking place over the past 9 years. I came to this country in 1997. I'm now a U.S. citizen. I really enjoy living in this country, and I appreciate the freedom conferred by the U.S. Constitution. I really love all of the people as a whole of America, and this society has accepted me as a full member, and having given me an opportunity to see another side of the world. The more I travel, the more I like America. Discussing about the white privilege, I have to admit, I lack of knowledge of American history, and especially racial issues. I observe and I learn about the social problems such as racial discrimination, educational discrimination, economic discrimination, and sexual personality discrimination, and stereotype, those kind of things. Mostly in an academic situation and business setting, not from my personal experience. To participate in our group presentation, I have had a chance to conduct a research. And I found white privilege is an advantage and a power white people have. It is not often to hear the word white privilege. Instead, racist is the term that we hear more commonly. These words are closely related, although the parallel is almost never drawn. And some scholars have described the white privilege as the flip side, meaning the other side of the racism. Discrimination of racism that a people of color are subject to in this country is the advantage and the protection of having white skin. White privilege is not only about experiences on an individual level, but it is a web of institutional and the cultural preferential treatment. And I found the scholar Sharon Martinez described white privilege as the preferential treatment to individuals whose ancestors came from Europe over the people whose ancestors came from America, Asia, Arabs, Africa, etc. This preferential treatment exempt European Americans from the form of racial and the national oppression inflicted upon people whose ancestors are not come from Europe. Although this is true today, but it has not always been true, because the ethnic groups people consider white have been changed many times over the year. You probably already know Asian American and Pacific Islander number about 9 million in the U.S. United States Constitution. About 3% of the U.S. population, mostly residing in California, New York, and the racial paradise of Hawaii. And Asian makes up, do you know the number? 65% of the world population. However, Asian American immigrant history is essential labor history. So now I'm talking about Chinese immigrant. Chinese immigration began in 1880s from Fujian, Guangdong, the provinces, provided labor, cheap labor, on the national railroad system and feed an American golden rush frenzy. Some of you may be told or remember in the 1990s, there was time Chinese people were not allowed to own real properties in the state of California. They could only acquire real properties through white people. And there were also turbulent times. The U.S. has crisis called Yellow Peril, which is believed Asian people will constitute a threat to the West civilization. Therefore, a Chinese Exclusion Act brought to a halt to all Chinese immigration until 1943. When Chinese workers brought to contribute to the World War II in the nation defense. You may check out your package to find out the Chinese Exclusion Act in your package. During that time, the local Chinese Americans can only open laundries, mini stores, and restaurants where they initially did a business primarily with each other. You may also take a glance at the cartoons in your package to see and interpret how Asian Americans were treated in the past. Many evidences show Chinese and Asian people have suffered a lot from discrimination in many ways. Now, things have changed significantly. Recent years, the wave of immigration have included scientists, students, scholars. They have been stereotyped as a model minority, meaning low crime rate, higher education level, and higher income occupation and high employment rate. Asian American now are 1.5 times more likely to have bachelor's degree, according to the statistics. However, does white privilege still exist in this country? You are the judges, and you are welcome to check the white privilege list on your package when you have the time. Unfortunately, I have been here only a few years. I'm unable to explain this subject according to my experience. Hopefully, knowledge, information, understanding will help us to build a stronger and a more equal America for all of us. Now, I introduce to me. Thank you.
Okay. I'll be honest and say that when Teresa decided we would do the subject, I was kind of shaky on it. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on and on and on for eons about racism and discrimination and that whole thing. But what I found interesting was that under the topic of white privilege, there were more white people that had more to say about it than I found black people did, which to me was really interesting. in other words, I felt like, okay, so we're not alone, and we're not the only ones that actually see it. But I just put a few words together, and so I'll read them. I'm nervous, but anyway. Okay, white privilege, an American history. White, having the color of pure snow or milk, opposite to black. Pure, innocent, a person with light-colored skin. Privilege, separate law, special right, favor, etc., granted to some person or group. These are definitions that I got out of Webster's Dictionary. If you are a person who fits the description of the first word, chances are you have received the second without any great effort. Unfortunately, this means that if you are not described by the first word, then you are considered to be non-white or more so a person of color, and the second word may not apply. It has been documented throughout the years that non-whites or people of color have not had the same opportunities as were allowed or even commanded of whites in America. Most whites would argue that there has been no special privilege granted to them, as it is an unwritten rule that if you are a non-white or person of color, you are assumed to be unequal to the capabilities and or abilities required for certain positions on the social and economic ladder. As the structure of America may not have been intentionally designed to keep others out of the white circle of life, it is obvious that for generations, people in the position of power have done so unknowingly. These ideas remain to be evident throughout history as certain classes have resulted to inadequacies forced upon them by the government. Education is one area in which non-whites have been subjected to racism and discrimination since before the 1800s, when slaves were not permitted to learn how to read and write. For generations, non-whites were not permitted an education, which resulted in children of the 1900s to be educated by family members who had not received any type of education that exceeded second or third grade. Many institutions of higher learning began to surface once people of color realized that this was the only way in which they could be educated in preparation for the day in which an equal opportunity for success would arise. The thought of non-whites becoming educated was an idea that white America did not want to become reality. This can be traced back to the time when school segregation was prevalent in southern United States. The Little Rock Nine of 1957 and the Brown versus Board of Education of 1954 were prime examples of how many whites did not approve of non-whites obtaining the same education, thus having the same opportunities that whites were born into. This was also an example of how strong non-whites felt about getting the education that they felt they rightfully were entitled to. As you can see on maybe you can't see because it's so far away, but Alex has put together like a little picture board, I guess you could say, and on it, there's one that has whites only. That's something that, you know, I would say from like 1900 up into the 60s, which is not that long ago. I remember my mother telling me stories of how when she was in high school, she wasn't allowed to go into the local Woolworth and sit at the counter and eat. And I thought, you know, that's not that long ago. I mean, she's only 20 years older than I am, so just the thought that she had to go through that was kind of like, wow. I mean, I've never experienced it, so, and hopefully I never will have to. But it's just, I don't know, it's just really interesting. But, many events have taken place throughout American history that provide detailed observations of white privilege. Jim Crow laws plagued the South, which obstructed non-whites from being a part of society and partaking in such events as voting on various laws that would in fact allow them more opportunities to advance. It prohibited non-whites, many of which were descendants of former slaves and sharecroppers, from visiting certain restaurants or occupying particular seats on a bus or train, or even living in a particular part of town. Where did this leave those who were displaced after the abolition of slavery? It left them without any resources in which to live. Many migrated to northern states. Many stayed in the rural South with hopes of a better future. Most were not educated enough to know that sharecropping was just another form of slavery. As a child, I can remember stories my grandparents would tell of how the white landowner would pay them pennies to work their tobacco fields, allowing them to live on the land while doing so. For the better of their six children, they did move north, where at least the next generation would have more opportunities than they were allowed as children and grandchildren of slaves. Although non-whites by law were given the right to vote, many of the southern states went to desperate measures to keep non-whites from voting. Tests were given that they could not pass. Fees were charged that they could not pay. Finally, the government stepped in and passed the Voter Rights Act of 1965, requiring that all American citizens, even non-whites, be given the equal opportunity to vote in the same capacity as whites. How does one progress and succeed if they are not given adequate necessities to do so? It is true that there are many issues to be addressed within the inner city today, we're talking about 2006, where most non-whites live. One of the most important issues that need to be addressed in the 21st century is still the issue of education, or the lack of. Many schools within the inner city lack basic resources. Books are an essential part of learning. However, most schools do not have enough books for the students who attend. This is another example of how the white power structure has been designed to delay non-whites from becoming successful. Is it a coincidence that only the schools with the highest test scores get the most funding? Or is it a coincidence that the schools that have the highest test scores are located in the more affluent areas where the PTA consists of doctors, lawyers, and most often prominent business owners that can afford to donate funds to the school in order to provide the necessities that the state does not, thus making the school the recipient of funds that are clearly needed elsewhere? How can one expect an institution of learning to get higher test scores if the resources are not there to prepare for the state-regulated testing? Separate but equal, an idea that resulted in the Jim Crow laws of the South many years ago, including to give the illusion that non-whites were being included as part of American society on an equal basis. The theory was that equal rights would be provided to all, but they were to remain separate. A concept that still exists, but cannot be seen by anyone who has not experienced or has not been exposed to such an unequal or discriminatory treatment throughout the history of the United States of America.
Anybody would like to ask us anything that we've learned? Thank you for your patience.
Well, I'll ask first.
I knew it. Let's go.
Well, you made a case, but now what are the alternatives?
Well, the alternatives are a few things. Jensen talks about dismantling the structure that only the white people have the power of using. So if they stop being racist or prejudiced to the non-white, then this will help them realize that they are human just like us. And if they start, you know, treating people the way they want to be treated, in every avenue, then that would be the first step towards dismantling it. And you know, everybody wants to be accepted in society, everybody. And there's so many groups that don't accept one person over the other. You know, and I have a personal experience. I went to predominantly black and Hispanic school in East LA, and the blacks didn't really live in my area, but they came from somewhere else. But we had a few whites, and maybe one or two. That was it. And purposely, people would be mean to them. Okay, so they felt the reverse discrimination that Jensen talks about in his book. And it wasn't fun. And when I saw this happening, or we saw this happening, there was a group of us. We couldn't believe that they were actually feeling the way we felt, and were getting upset. And we felt this person's like us. This person is just it, you know. And we're gonna let this happen. We're gonna let all the cholos and the cholas beat them up. And you know, we need to protect this guy. I mean, they weren't even bothering the Asians, and you know, they like to beat up Asians. But you know, hey, we went over there and we just said we're not gonna do it. We're not going to do this, and if you do it, don't do it while we're all watching. And it helps, and that helps. But, you know, acceptance and equal opportunity of earned privileges, if everybody just puts in and gets out what they put in, that's part of it. I work hard, but do I get back the 100% privilege? Well, you know what? I hope so. I hope I do. I think I do. But who knows? With this new structure, which really threw me, you know, I'm thinking, oh my God, all this time, you know, who's taking me back? But if we all just try a little harder, then all of us would benefit in the future. You know, and so we need to to just dismantle this white structure, you know, just for the sake of humanity, okay, and survival. How are we going to survive without each other? And how, you know, with the minorities, you know, coming in, with all the immigrants coming into this country, you guys are not going to be the majority anymore. You know, it's going to be the minorities, the majority. You know, we got to stick together and do it, you know, with the human race. And so that our nation, you know, our nation that was founded on the American Constitution, you know, it states even equality for all, not just for some.
Your question was, what's the alternative? That was your question. What is the alternative? I don't know that there is an alternative, but I'm a strong believer that racism and discrimination, that is a learned behavior. And I truly believe that it starts with children. Because children only know what they're taught. And I'll give you an example. My daughter, she was in the second grade. And she was going to Highland Oaks Avenue School in Arcadia. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the area or whatever. But she was going to Highland Oaks. And she came home from school one day, and she was really, really upset. And I was like, well, you know, what happened? Like, what's wrong? She was like, Mommy, the little boy in my class, he said, he told me. And mind you, you know, we're talking a student body of maybe 700, 800 kids. And of the student body, only about 10 of them were black. So you could imagine already the uncomfortableness she felt every day going to school. But because I've raised her not to see color, it's like people are people, and she doesn't have a problem with, you know, she has friends of all races right now today, you know, that she's been really close friends with since she's been in school. But the long and the short of it was, the little boy was making fun of her because she was black. And what he said to her was, "Ooh, you're the darkest one in the class." And I told her, well, you go to school tomorrow and you tell him, not only am I the darkest one, but I'm the prettiest and the smartest. So, but that's how I'm raising my child. Yeah, yeah. Because I feel, you know, like I said, it's a learned behavior. And until somebody breaks the cycle of, you know, right is right and wrong is wrong. I don't care what color you are, you know, what ethnicity you are, whatever. But like she said, you treat people as you would want them to treat you. You know, and that's just an alternative.
So we act together as one and not separate.
Thank you.
Thank you.